Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Calmversations with the Boyce of Reason. I'm your host, Benjamin Boyce, and today's guest is Professor Bruno Chauat, who is a professor of French literature at the University of Minnesota. He's also affiliated with the Holocaust and Genocide Studies and the Jewish Studies Centers in this institution. In this conversation, we talk about a whole lot. He's the epitome of a French intellectual, which is a good thing in this instance. No, why'd you say that? We talk about critical theory, and we talk about transhumanism and humanism, enlightenment values, hubris, and many another facet of current discourse and its outgrowth from ancient orders of knowledge. Specifically, we talk about Gnosticism, and we talk about the state of intellectual discourse in America right now. This is a very wide-ranging and very deep discussion, and I had a whole lot of fun because one of my things is being kind of a French intellectual in a good sense. Why do I keep saying that? Without further ado, here's Bruno Chauat. So you're a professor of literature specifically? Or?
Yeah, I teach French literature, and I also work in the Center for Jewish Studies at the University of Minnesota. I've been here for, almost 20 years.
Okay.
So it's been a while, yeah. And in America for 30 years.
Okay. And you've been an academic this whole time?
Pretty much. I was a graduate student in the U.S. and then got a job and in 1995 and then was an academic for all that time, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you enjoy it in there, in the tower?
Do, in the tower?
The ivory tower, as it's called?
Yeah. I do enjoy it. I love teaching. I really miss my students because of the crisis. And it's very tough, you know, to teach online. I dislike it very much. It's too disembodied for me.
Mm.
And so I miss that contact with students. And I love writing. I love doing research. So I'm blessed in many ways. I like the politics much less. But like
what
most
politics
of us,
could those possibly be?
Well, you know, boring bureaucracy, Kafkaesque situations, and also the lack of genuine intellectual engagement that I've noticed for a while now, actually for a long time. It's not, it may be structural, it may be a problem related to higher education in general. It's hard for me to compare. I've not really noticed a sort of that lack of engagement. I have the impression that there is a sort of fear and anxiety of engaging at the intellectual level. So it's engagement at the sort of trivial level, bureaucratic, administrative level. But when it comes to ideas and politics, it's much more difficult. It may be also an American trait. It's hard for me to say. They are much more, there is much more open, I would say, engagement in France than in the U.S. That's my observation. It's very empirical.
Mm-hmm. And are you, your teaching style, is that very lectural? Do you do a lot of lectures or seminars kind of stuff?
That's the French way is to lecture. So what I do is I lecture and we discuss. You know, the classes are very small. In French in particular. Sometimes I teach in English, so classes are a bit bigger. But usually it's mainly lecturing. Now I do PowerPoint, you know, I engage students with citations in particular. They read less and less. 20 years ago, they read, I think, much more. I think now it's like very short reading assignments work. Longer, it's much more difficult. I'm not generalizing. You know, there are students, undergrads, who are extraordinary readers, actually, and voracious. But there are students who are, you know, I would say the majority of students really don't read much, especially in a foreign language, which I can understand. It's very, very difficult. And so they just, we dissect small pieces of citations and things like that. Mm-hmm. That's what we do. We read closely and short pieces.
Such as what? Literature?
Yeah. Yeah, so the last course that I'm nostalgic for is the one I taught a year and a half ago, I think, before that COVID thing.
Yeah.
And it was an introduction to French literature. And the theme was from humanism to transhumanism. And it was really fascinating because we started with 16th century Renaissance type of humanism and ended up on 20th century text and debates regarding transhumanism, even in the US and the Silicon Valley. And we showed that there was some kind of continuity actually between the old European humanism and its, its sort of voracity or voraciousness for always going further, always reading more, always, I'm thinking of Montaigne in particular, 16th century Renaissance, wonderful essayist, always, always knowing more, always exceeding the limits of the human, all the while insisting on forms of moderation, right? Mm. And we realized that there has been a sort of perhaps a perversion of the humanistic project, at the same time continuity and rupture and disruption, if you will, with the transhumanism, which is also a sort of attempt at going beyond the human, right? But it's a beyond that is irreversible and that is, I think, much more deleterious than the good old humanism. In the sense that it resembles more sort of Promethean hubris than what the... But at the same time, you know, I'm thinking, there's this Pico de la Mirandola, I don't know if you know this, Renaissance Italian thinker, who wrote a book called On the Dignity of Man. It's actually a short kind of manifesto in the 16th century. And Pico de la Mirandola says that man is actually a chameleon. And that, you know, and there is this sort of that Proteus character of the human is something that I've been interested in a while now. Proteus in the sense that man always wants to escape his condition. And so I wrote a book in French that is not translated called The Transhuman about starting with this quote that I love by Albert Camus, the existentialist, whom you know. In the 1950s, he wrote a book called The Rebel, L'Homme Révolté. And in that book, he has an incredible quote in which he says, man is the only creature who, if I translate well, who refuses to be what he is. And that's, that's very summative, that's very summary, that's very concise, but it says a lot about the human condition as a condition of dissatisfaction, of discontent, and a condition of aspiration to transcend the limitations in general that are the given, you know, biological given, cultural, social determinations, you name it. There is also an imagination in the human that is the imagination of the non-human, which is actually specific, I think, to the human. It sounds like paradoxical, but it's as if the proper or the main specificity of the human were actually to be able to imagine an exit from the human condition. If you think of your cat, I tell my students, you know, if you think of your cat probably doesn't have this aspiration to be something else than what he or it is, you know. But we human always want to go beyond.
Well, do you think that that's an outgrowth of Western society and the Enlightenment specifically? Do you think that in some way humanism concentrated that desire to refine and go beyond what already is and then just sped up that particular property?
Because you can go back at least to the Renaissance, but even in the Antiquity you have Prometheism. You know, you have those myths of hubris, you know, those myths of individuals who want to be like the gods, right? So it seems to me that it's not necessarily dated to the Enlightenment. It is certainly accented here during the Enlightenment, this idea of an indefinite progress. You have actually a heralding, if it's a word, of transhumanism in the 1780s, I believe, with Condorcet, the Marquis de Condorcet, who writes on the progress of the human mind, I think, Le Progrès de l'Esprit Humain. And Condorcet, C-O-N-D-O-R-C-E-T, actually goes so far as to imagine the possibility of immortality. So it is true that there is this hubris, if you will, in the Enlightenment project. But I think it's more ontological. It is more related to our human condition, perhaps to the condition of the creature that has language, as Aristotle used to say, that we are capable of imagining something outside or beyond, if you will, the human. I don't know. Maybe I'm too pedantic.
Well, what do you think are the limiting principles? You brought up moderation. Where do you think moderation or the lack of moderation fits into transhumanism as we are now accessing it through medical and technological means?
The moderation. First of all, there has been always this moderation of religion, right? And so the law in Judaism, for example, the law is something that puts a sort of limit. The nomos, you know, this sort of idea that you have to be restrained by something. You know, all the regulations and the rules in monotheism and particularly in Judaism have to do with limiting our aspiration to go too far. The Greeks knew the notion of hubris and condemned that and showed in their tragedy that hubris was always going to take us too far. And so there was a kind of physis, which means, you know, the nature and the idea of nomos, of the law and the institutions are supposed to prevent us from going too far. So if it's possible today to go too far, it may be first of all because it's technically possible, or it's becoming technically possible, but also because symbolically speaking, there are less safeguards. perhaps what some French intellectuals have called a crisis of the institutions, right? A crisis of mediations and institutions, and a form of, more and more a form of what I would call anomie, the absence of nomos, the privation of a law that restricts, basically. And it is a factor probably of the rise of hyper-individualism. That's possible. You know, if you look at the Silicon Valley emperors or whatever, you know, they are kings in their kingdom, and they are hyper-individuals in many ways, right? And they want immortality. Interestingly, it's almost, in my research, I've almost always found only men, as in male, who wanted to clone themselves, you know, who wanted to reproduce themselves without the mediation of another, that is the woman, you know. So it is also interesting. It may be, after all, a male fantasy, you know, this idea of
the self-birthed one, the self-made.
Self-made, self-birth, cloning. You know, it's very rare to encounter female transhuman. I'm sure that there are, you know, I've not done enough research in sociology of the transhumanist community, mm-hmm. but it's the name that immediately come to our mind when we think about, you know, Kurzweil and all those people, those transhumanists are almost always men. Men have a huge anxiety with regard to death, and perhaps more than women who give birth, I think. It's possible, you know, it's a pure speculation, right? Mm-hmm. But that's the only way I can understand why it is so male-centered, this fantasy of going beyond, not going beyond, but circumventing, so to speak, a relation to the other sex, if you will, for reaching immortality. And this is very disturbing. You know, in the past, there were those men geniuses. So they produced their work, their opus, and the opus was supposed to be them, but in immortal form, right? Mm-hmm. But nowadays, that culture is in crisis, and that the works of art are more and more ephemeral, right? I think and transient, so to speak, I think that what we are seeing is a decline of this fantasy of immortality through a perennial, you know, artwork or book or memoir or whatnot, and the rise of an imminent materialistic, purely materialistic striving for self-continuation, be it in the form of cyber immortality or cloning or other strange ways and modes of persisting.
I have this kind of this fantasy for a while of if I speak enough into the internet, if I speak enough into YouTube, if I upload enough of myself, the AIs will be infected by me. And my personality, my curiosity, the different parameters of my inventiveness and the ways in which fingerprints that I put on language would persist, and I would become a part of that thing and constantly be exerting my influence in a way. It's not as concentrated because I don't own any of those algorithms, and it is totally dependent on machines being able to work for a while. And then it's also dependent on other people witnessing and recognizing that or speaking into those machines that are echoing me through. Mm-hmm. But I think it could be a, you know, possibility. Algorithms are basically black boxes right now. We really don't know how they do what they do. Eventually, they're just going to start doing things. So in a way, I think we're toying with it right now.
There is I love the TV show Black Mirror, which you probably know, right?
Yeah.
You don't, but it's a wonderful TV show with lots of scenarios of that type with AI. I think that it remains at the level of fantasy because we always think of human thought, of artificial intelligence on the same level. We think of AI in terms of analogy with human intelligence. Mm-hmm. But it is possible that the human thinks in a way that AI will never be able to think. There was a wonderful essay that influenced me a lot when I was a student, I think, in the 1990s, by Lyotard, who has been my one of my professors. And he wrote an incredible essay, which I think is published in a book that may be entitled The Inhuman, I think. Mm-hmm. It's in English, and the essay is called "Can there be a thought without a body?" And the answer is in the question. For Lyotard, it's impossible. It was impossible because the embodiment, you see, makes our human thought an embodied thought, as opposed to a pure computational thought. And it means that thought is not calculation. Thought is not only rationality. It is rationality, but not only rationality. Mm. Thought, what I call thought, is connected to the aesthetic body. In other words, to a body that receives stimuli and that receives pain and pleasure, and a body and a mind that know and that are aware that they were born and are going to die. And I am not sure that we can get there with AI. Although I have no idea, because it's possible maybe to construct an AI that would feel pain. That would have sensorium, so to speak, apparatus. Yes, you wanted to.
Well, we already encode our embodied experience in a form of language. It's just not in the form of rationality. It's called story or narrative. So eventually, if you feed enough narrative, which is an embodied experience, it's the simulation of an embodied experience. There's a world, there's character, and then there's a bunch of characters. And then the thoughts are possessed by the characters, and the characters themselves have this notion of death and life and desire and pain and suffering. So if the artificial intelligence can start to become a storyteller, it's just one more step or a billion more steps before you start to have it being able to generate characters as real as, let's say, Emily Bronte's characters or as Dostoevsky's characters. Eventually, because those are all working with a narrative, they're just a late stage of narrative where you have that embodiment or that giving forth of life of these specters of humans.
So it is possible at the level of the mechanics or the level of the syntax, yes. It's sure you can do it with music as well. You can compose music with AI and so on and so forth. And it's very hard to distinguish, right? For connoisseur, is it a real Bach or is it an AI Bach? Imitation or simulation. It's very difficult to figure out which one is which. I continue to believe that true and genuine creativity, at least in the sense that we understand it, is not going to be attainable by AI. And it's not a hierarchical judgment that I make. I'm not saying AI is less intelligent. Actually, AI is probably much more intelligent, obviously, than we are. It's very clear in many ways. But it's a qualitatively a different type of intelligence. And I think there is a misunderstanding in general when we make comparisons, because we think in terms of degree, but not in terms of quality. We think in terms of quantity, and quantitatively we've lost a long time ago, a long, long time ago, right, on the computer. We've lost with chess, we've lost with so many things. So that's not a question. But at the level of what I call the aesthetic body, that is the body that suffers, the body that is also a pathetic, not in the trivial sense of the word, but in the sense of the pathos, of the affect. This body is actually, in my opinion, the hardware necessary for a genuine thought and a genuine creation. So, you know, maybe I'm narrow-minded, and maybe, and certainly I don't know enough about artificial intelligence. But, you know, for example, if you take, like, why is it that 2001 Space Odyssey is such an extraordinary movie? And why is it that it's also science fiction, despite everything that sounds reachable, attainable, possible in the near future, and so on? Because in my opinion, an AI is never going to be jealous. An AI is never going to be paranoid. It will be able to simulate paranoia and jealousy, but it will never be jealous or paranoid because it has not experienced loss. And the human experiences loss at birth, so and beyond birth. So I think that what is so incredible in the anthropomorphizing of HAL 9000 is precisely that HAL 9000 experiences something that we know bloody well that AI cannot experience: jealousy. He is jealous, you remember, right, of the astronauts or whatever. He is jealous because, and he's paranoid, and he imagined that there is a conspiracy against him and that he's not trusted anymore. And all those passions are, those emotions are very human. So that's what make the character of HAL 9000 so extraordinary and so science fictional, in my view.
If the aesthetic body is the container of creativity as we understand it, under what conditions can transhumanism unlock or distill our creativity without it us losing it?
So I've lost connection, Ben.
Okay. Are you there? Are you there?
Now I'm here.
Okay. Can you hear me and see me? Am I moving?
Yeah, I can see you. It's very strange. I don't exactly know. You know, I know Zoom better than I know Skype. Okay. It seems to be working now. I can see you.
Okay.
So transhumanism, you said? I'm sorry.
Yeah, can that make us more creative? Can that what do you see there with the fiddling of man with his aesthetic, pathetic body, to make it a little less pathetic in the derogatory term, perhaps? Is there something that might be lost there? Is there something that might be gained through
experiments in transhumanism?
Yeah, through boosting it through these different ways, switching hormones, getting implants.
Oh, it's a hard question.
Adding a third arm just because you want to?
Yeah, I think that it does, for me, it responds to a fantasy of overcoming the flesh, of overcoming the body. It is, how to put it, and also overcoming sexuality in many ways. You know, death and sexuality go together, and they both actually provoke some form of anxiety. And Freud once said, I don't know if people read Freud anymore, or if he's not considered very seriously anymore by psychologists, in the US in particular. He's still very, very important in France, actually, in continental philosophy as well. But Freud once said a sentence that keeps resonating and accompanies me all the time. He said something like, the man or the person who will be announcing to humankind that he knows how to abolish sexuality will be welcome as the Messiah. You know, and so in this whole, you know, this whole idea that especially men, as I said, are actually looking for ways away from this pain and anxiety of sexuality. And it is what also leads me to believe that there may be some aspect of that in certain cases of transgenderism or transitioning. Especially among very young people, right? A certain anxiety vis-a-vis sexuality. Because when you think of those very young people who are asking for hormone blockers, for example, it's very interesting it's very poignant in many ways, because those young people, first of all, they are convinced that they are something that their body is not, right? But they also may be terrified by growth, right? After all, a hormone blocker is something that blocks puberty, that blocks the moment of, quote-unquote, the natural transition, right? So the moment of, you know, where you go from child to adult, which means this extremely troubling and disturbing and turbulent phase of becoming, right? And that is extremely anxiety triggering. So think about young men, young boys, I mean boys who, teenagers who have their voice changing. That is a very strange experience, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that, but it can be almost traumatic. I mean, strange anyway. Not traumatic, but strange. Mm-hmm. Same for menstruation, for, you know, girls, and so on and so forth. So there is something that resonated with the Freud sentence for me, that maybe sexuality may be the moment, you know, of the encounter with the possibility of sexuality is something that is very, very scary. And that would perhaps explain a sort of contagion or sort of, you know, a large number of young people who are trying to delay or postpone maybe this moment, right?
Well, if you can, there's a lot of currents within gender ideology that make this concept of gender equatable with the soul. And it is principle and should be principle over the body. And there are arguments within that that says that the body is kind of basically a lie, and the reality is your gender, and your gender should be whatever you want it to be, and access to changing your body to align with this feeling, and they call it a feeling, and it's very circular. It's very circular because it has nothing to do with sex. It's all about gender, which is completely free. But if you can force your body to align with your soul, then that's ultimately what human beings have always wanted to do. At least on the very small earth of our body, we now are lords over it. And our soul, we can impose our will upon the earth of our own bodies.
This is what took me to study Gnosticism. When I say that, people say, oh, you're an agnostic. So I say, no, I say Gnostic, not agnostic, first of all. Second, it's hard to pronounce for a Frenchman in English because the G is not pronounced in English. It is pronounced in Greek and in French. So it's Gnostic.
how do the French do it? Gnosis?
Gnostic. Gnostic.
Gnostic, yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty much gnosis, gnosis in Greek, right? So it means knowledge or secret knowledge or whatever. And I was a long time ago now, because I'm a very slow writer. It was a while ago. It had to mature for a long time. But I was at the dentist and I was reading a magazine, you know, like People or whatever that was. And it was a while ago, because I remember it was the time when Bruce Jenner became Kathleen Jenner. Mm-hmm. And I read the interview with People magazine. And the interview was very striking, because at some point, Kathleen Jenner says, finally, I have become my real self, or something like that, my true self. Something like that, right? A form of affirmation of an authenticity, which was not there before. And it really sort of resonated for me with this ancient movement called Gnosticism. You know about it a little bit? Could you sketch it for the audience?
Give us the basis.
So it's a little tricky. Some people say it does not exist because there are too many varieties of Gnosticism. So maybe Gnosticism is the wrong word for it. It used to be called heresy, but of course we're not going to call it heresy today. So they decided, historians call it now heterodoxies, like the Heterodox Academy, right? But it's not a Gnostic academy. It's another story. But anyway, those heterodox were movements that parted away from Orthodox or Apostolic Christianity in the early centuries of the Church. They have tons of influence, Asian, Middle Eastern, you name it. Geographically, it's quite complicated. But what may be a common feature of all those different so-called heresies of Christianity are a sense that the world is wrong, or that the world is created by a God who was malevolent. It's the concept of the evil demiurge. Right, the demiurge, that is the creator of worlds, so of people, the creator is basically malignant, malevolent, and wanted our misery and affliction. So we have to repudiate this evil God, and we have to find the real God, and the real God is an alien God. It's not a God from this world, because this world is not something, you know, that is good. But the real God is good, entirely good. And therefore we have to find, and the Gnostic is the one, someone who is a Gnostic is someone who thinks that he or she has kept a spark of this alien God. And the spark is called in Greek the pneuma, like a pneumatic, or you know the word pneuma, which
spirit.
Means like a pneumonia, right? So it has to do with the breath, with breathing, right? It's not yet, spirit is another translation for, it's the translation for that actually, yeah. And this spirit of the, so when I read Caitlyn Jenner interview, I thought it's very strange. It sounds a little bit like the ancient Gnostic who thought that that this embodied self is wrong, so to speak, and that the truth of the self is somewhere else to be found. And so I am not saying that the people who, like Caitlyn Jenner, go to transition are Gnostics, but I'm saying that there are some very intriguing similarities in the reasoning, especially the idea of going, of trying to find the real self beneath, before, or beyond. You don't know the location, right? It's impossible to locate because it's not in the brain, it's not in the heart, it's not in the organs, it's not, so you don't really know where it is. So, you know, beyond the created, sexuated, as I call it, body, right? And that's really interesting because then I did some research and found out that there are scholars of Gnosticism who actually have found some queer Gnostics and some Gnostics, ancient Gnostics, who believed that there was no, that the true, the genuine condition of man is not differentiated sexual, there is no sexual difference. The sexual difference has been introduced by the evil god, right? And so we have to go beyond that sexual difference because it's all about evil and it's demonic. It's, you know, and so it's possible to have, and some have done it, a queer reading of the ancient Gnostics, if you will. But what I would like to do is a Gnostic reading of the queer movement. I think it would be very interesting. I mean, that's what I a little bit sort of sketched in my book, yeah, on the transhuman. But I think it's a very interesting idea. And I discovered recently this book thanks to a friend of mine. Can you see it? Or because
no,
I cannot
future
see,
queer theory I and the death drive.
I cannot see my face anymore, so I don't
even,
I
can see it.
I cannot see the camera. Okay. So in this book was published 10 years ago or something like that by Duke University Press. So it's like an academic, very jargonish, very tedious, you know, book to read, but also very interesting because it is, when you think about it, it is a queer theoretical book. Very orthodox within the queer theory, right? Very Butlerian and so on and so forth, you know, Judith Butler and so on. But it actually celebrates the anti-natalist or anti-procreation idea that having children is actually subjecting yourself to heteronormativity and heteropatriarchy, right? So you see how it can function, even if it's completely secular. Of course, queer theory is entirely secular, but nonetheless, it seems to me that there are vestiges or maybe resurgences of some what I would call Gnostic sparks, if you will, or vestiges.
Nuance.
Huh?
Pneumas.
How do you call it? Nuance.
Pneuma?
Yeah.
Pneuma?
Pneuma.
Gnostic pneuma. I was just playing the word.
Exactly.
Word
game. Yeah, I say pneuma. You say pneuma. It's always this P or this G that I pronounce from the Greek. So pneuma, exactly. So there are always some sort of resurgences of a certain Gnostic narrative, even if we are way beyond the death of God.
Yeah.
in secularism.
Patriarchy is the God. I mean, there's a definite correlation between Yahweh and the patriarchy, in many different respects. But let's take that as a given, that there's a resurgence of Gnosticism. And we can read into a lot of texts the patterns of this story, the latent this story kind of bubbling up. What's the boundary of that story, and what would you argue for or against with using that story? What's the pitfall or the flaw in living your life like that?
Are you asking me to make a moral judgment?
not a moral for what's the benefit of that and the cost of that, or how does that end up? How does that pattern shape your life? Let's just say.
So in the 1950s, there was, I'm sorry, I'm a scholar, so I have those references. it's a little pedantic. But in 1950, there is a text that really inspired me a lot and influenced me. It's Hans Jonas. Hans Jonas was a German Jewish philosopher who was a student of Heidegger. And he came up with a book in the 1950 that he started probably 20 years before that. It took him a very long time. It's the first, for the 20th century, it's the first major book about Gnosticism. It's called The Gnostic Religions, very important, major volume. And in that book, there is an afterword. And in the afterword, there is a Gnostic reading of existentialism. And so Hans Jonas makes the argument that Nietzsche, Heidegger, his former professor, mentor, and even Sartre have something Gnostic in them. So I would be incapable of summarizing his demonstration. It's very complex and very technical. But he ends up saying that those philosophies ultimately are nihilistic. Those philosophies are ultimately based on some form of relativism and nihilism. And so he actually, interestingly, bears almost a moral judgment on the movement of existentialism, which, of course, he admires and to which, to an extent, he belongs himself. But nonetheless, he makes this judgment that basically it leads to forms of nihilism and a sort of hyper-individualism, etc. And so I would say that what you have in a book like No Future, it's in your title, right? It's not just a book about very brilliant, he has actually superb analysis of Hitchcock movies in that book. So I recommend, in a way, it's a good book in a way, but it's also crazy in the sense that it celebrates what it analyzes. And that always scares me a little bit. So it analyzes Birds by Hitchcock, which is indeed a movie about no future. It's a movie which is atrocious, right? It ends up with a no future. It ends up with the end of the world. Those birds are going to kill everyone. So anyway, and there is a sense that he embraces this idea of the absence of something that can come after new generations. And it's interesting that you talk about Yahweh, because think about Judaism. Judaism is all about generation. It's all about transmission. Le dor vador in Hebrew, that prayer we say, on Shabbat, it's from generation to generation. We have to transmit. Now, if there is
not transcend, but transmit.
Not transcend, exactly. It's tradition. It's not. It's not. It's very different. Tradition is very different from that sort of transcendence that I've been talking about, which there is a form of transcendence in Judaism, which is, of course, the relation to God, the relation to the other, and so on. But nonetheless, this right now, I'm talking of a tradition. And the tradition means that you need to have a descendance. It's necessary. It's required. So the critique that we see today, and even the condemnation of patriarchy, even if I am all in favor of old type, I don't know which way, if you want to call it, of feminism, that is equal rights, absolute equal rights for women and equal opportunities and so on. What I'm seeing today is very different. It's actually a condemnation, not just of patriarchy, which was the old Simone de Beauvoir, maybe, type of feminism, but of heteropatriarchy, which, or hetero, whatever, which means what? Which means the relation to the other that basically, heteros in Greek is the other, which basically results in reproduction, which results in generation, is what we are opposing. So if that is not nihilism, I don't know what is. Yeah. Does it make any sense?
No. Okay, yeah. Thank you for rooting nihilism in something that's very material. And my main challenge to queer theory or gender ideology, this post-pronoun world and all the variations of all these genders, is that I want this group to produce an epic, a cultural epic. And I don't think they'll be able to, because there will be no generation in there. And a cultural epic embeds generation. A mythos has male, female, and it has that spontaneous intersection. Now, maybe you could conceive of a world that has no gender, that has no sex, where things, difference comes from the same. Maybe, like, there's this.
So there have been some experiments in France in the 19. When was that?
Yeah, you French people are always ahead of the curve, literally speaking.
We've had Simone de Beauvoir, and I admire her very much. She said something very strange, right? She said, "You're not born a woman; you become a woman.
You're made a woman."
And there is a complete misreading of that by some queer theorists. Or some queer theorists say she didn't go far enough. She stayed within the paradigm of heterosexuality. And some say, well, you see, she's basically heralding and announcing Judith Butler and the idea that everything is a performance. But that's not at all what she was saying if you read her closely. So there have been experiments in literature in France, in sort of experimental novel by someone called Monique Wittig, a very interesting figure, the lesbian, who wrote a book called The Lesbian Body and other books that are narratives, actually. I don't know if they are epic, because it depends on how we define epic. But there is a form of epic, in fact, in what she does. And it's all about playing with the gender indeterminacy and pronouns a lot and so on. So to my knowledge, she is one case, let's say, of experimental literature, that produces actually a work that is very interesting. I'm sure that there are many which I don't follow, because I don't really work or read that literature. But I don't really know. You know, I think that. But you know, to go back to Yahweh, I'm obsessed with this idea, because the thing with the Gnostics, right, is that they were first and foremost opposed to the Creator. And, I mean, again, you know, that's, I'm summarizing, and I'm actually, I'm reducing and subsuming all those different trends in ancient narcissism within a couple of features, but it's much more nuanced. Okay,
yeah.
But let's say that some of them were very opposed to the demiurge. Some of them even, if you can see Marcion, the Gospel of the Alien God, it sounds like Raëlien or new cult, new age, title.
Yeah.
Gospel of the Alien. And it is, in a way, because New Age has been very inspired also knowingly or unknowingly by Gnosticism. And so the idea for Marcion, how do you pronounce in English, was actually to decouple the Hebrew scripture from the New Testament. Because the Hebrew scripture was all about evil and bad, you know, and the bad God and the evil gods. And the New Testament was all about this alien God, Jesus, who is not from this world, right? So there are some scholars, I'm thinking of Gershom Scholem in particular, who was a scholar of Jewish mysticism, and who said, you know, if you want to look at the metaphysical roots of anti-Semitism, you have to go into Gnosticism. If you really want to, you know, because then you have, other manifestations of anti-Semitism or anti-Judaism, Christian, and so on. But if you want to look, yes, go ahead, I'm sorry. You want to?
No, continue. So he was saying that yeah. Anti-Semitism has its roots in this imaginative Gnostic tradition.
So according to Gersh, first, I think it's completely anachronistic to talk about anti-Semitism for the ancients, right? We talk about something else. But what there is that there is a rebellion against a figure who is symbolically a father figure and a figure of creation, right? So a figure of world affirmation. And what you have in Gnosticism is a form of world denial, okay? And it goes with the rejection of the Hebrew scripture when it gets really radical, like in Marcion. What you have is a rejection of the Hebrew scripture and an invention of a Jesus who is not a Jew, okay? So you can imagine how it played in the hands also of Nazism, because the Nazis had to find a way of pleasing the church for political reasons, all the while being anti-Semitic. And so they thought that Aryanizing Jesus was a good idea. So saying Jesus was basically not quote-unquote Semitic, he was not a Jew, he was an Aryan. There is a trace of Marcionism, you see, in Nazi theology, in theology in the time of, in the age of the Third Reich. There are books written on that. One is called The Aryan Jesus in particular. So it's very interesting. So you see, so there is a form of continuity between those ancient trends of world denial, procreation denial, generation denial, sexual difference denial as well, to an extent. The world as it is, if you will, right? As we inhabit it, and that is celebrated by Judaism. It's always every prayer in Judaism, as you probably know, is bless this fruit, bless this bread, bless everything that comes in this world. That's basically what it is, right? So what you have with the metaphysical rebellion of Gnosticism is the exact opposite. Is cursed be this world and cursed be having children and having this and that. So I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you know, when you think of the movement in France in the Middle Ages called the Cathar, C-A-T-H-A-R, I think, which comes from catharsis in Greek, which means purified, right? Pure, purity. So the pure ones, there was a sect called the Cathar in the Middle Ages in France, in the Pyrenees, and they were radically against having children and radically against the flesh. So in general, so they wouldn't eat. They were vegetarians, for example, because meat was flesh and flesh was corrupt and corruption was what they were against. But sex and generation, regeneration, and procreation was also corrupt, and so on and so forth. Okay, so mm-hmm. that's very interesting because you have, it would be interesting actually to look into certain radical vegan movements, for mm-hmm. example, and take mm-hmm. a look at their text and see if there are some reminiscences, if you will, of yeah. those movements.
There's something in queer theory in the aesthetic. There's something kind of. I'm thinking of something in particular, but I've seen this kind of aesthetic quality of things being very pornographic but not sexy, being very pornographic but not erotic at all, and being like kind of the cartoonized. Distilled version of sex when it just becomes like these caricatures of sex, but it's missing the sensuality. It's a rebellion from the sensuality. Mm. It's a rebellion from the flavors and the taste, the sensations, and it's distilled into this kind of this archetype or this by pornography. I mean, it's kind of virtual. It's mitigated by the virtual world.
It is possible. I'm also thinking of when you talk about pornography and of forms of rebellion against creation, not that I think that queer is rebellion against creation. There are certain movements within queer, like the book I was mentioning, which are explicitly a rebellion against creation. But I was thinking of the Marquis de Sade and his pornography, you know. And the Marquis de Sade is the absolute example of rebellion against God, right? Of the one who is showing God who he really is, right? and all his books are about destroying or rivalizing. Can you say that? To be the rival? Rival.
Okay. Yeah.
To rivalize.
I like that.
Competing.
Yeah.
Competing with God and killing God and so on and so forth. So everything has to do with that. And sodomy actually is part of the whole endeavor, because sodomy does not procreate or does not make children. You know, so there is a form of sexuality which is not.
That denies the basic process that gives rise to other human beings.
Yeah, and also maybe it is also extremely deseroticized in many ways because of its violence and because of its mechanical, completely mechanical and choreographed aspect of the orgy in the Marquis de Sade. Yeah. So I would say that there is something that you can see actually in Kubrick. I'm a big Kubrick fan, as you can see. He is one of my favorite filmmakers. And in his last movie, Eyes Wide Shut, you see an orgy, which is very Sadian, sad-like, right? You've seen maybe Eyes Wide Shut. This kind of, you know, mechanics of sex, which is frankly not the eroticism that we're talking about. The coldness, this coldness. So... yeah. So then again, you know, I'm not sure about whether there is. I don't know queer culture well enough to make pronouncements about it, about this aesthetic. But I think that the idea of world denial seems to be very important. And what's interesting is that it has given birth, if I may use that metaphor, to lots of extraordinary books and texts and works, you know. Think of authors, especially the French, who are perverts, as you know, like Jean Genet, you know, queer, gay writer, and many other, who were competing with God. I'm thinking of 19th century so-called modern, or the beginning of what we in France call modern poetry, which is second half of the 19th century, with Baudelaire and L'Autre-Amont and authors like this who were all blasphémateurs and all people who were cursing God and trying to kill this figure. So So it gave birth to lots of literary production, epic, I don't know.
It releases a lot of energy, Rebellion does. A lot of creative energy is released, but it's kind of spent. It's diverted from being captured back into life and generating more of itself. And it's this explosion, very masculine usually, in a way.
Yeah, and Albert Camus wrote against that. In The Rebel, the book I mentioned in the beginning of our conversation, he wrote against what he calls metaphysical rebellion. He says rebellion is necessary. That's what makes us human, right? So we have to rebel against the breach, the attack against human dignity. So a slave must rebel. An exploited worker must rebel against the conditions and so on and so forth. A black man in the South, segregated, must rebel. So this is, for Camus, this is the righteous rebellion. But then there is another rebellion that leads to nihilism, and it's what he calls the metaphysical rebellion against creation, against the world.
To wrap this back to where we started, can there be a transhumanism that increases the dignity and celebrates the dignity of the human, as opposed to the transhumanism that ends up being an escape or immortalization of the human and a rebellion from the constraints of man?
No, I don't think so. I think what you can have is all the devices of enhancing, or no, I should say it differently, everything that has to do with correction and with curing and with care, even if they sound very transhumanist, such as stuff that you put in your ears to hear, they have that you actually implant. I don't know the name in English. Cochlear implants, I think. Yeah. Or if you're blind or if you don't see well, eyes that make you see. I think that there are lots of things, as long as it's restorative and reparative, I am more in favor of that. It is forms of transhumanism because it actually puts, people who are handicapped and cannot move their arms, and there are mechanisms now and devices that you can use the interface with a computer to make your arms move and so on and so forth. I am all in favor of that, actually, with caution, but certainly I'm in favor of that. But when it comes to enhancing the human who is not disabled, who is not in a situation of pain or suffering or at this point I am against that sort of what we call augmentation, right, of the human, which, by the way, is something you see in militaries more and more. It's a debate that they have in militaries all over the world. In the West, it's how are we going to do, and China does that if they don't already do that, right? It's augment, basically.
So you're okay with coffee, but not with Adderall for fixing your drowsiness in the morning, then?
Exactly. Okay. Yes. I am in favor of medicine and technical progress. There is no doubt about biotechnical progress. Of course, we all benefit from that. All of us. But the idea that you would make a new man, a homo novus, is extraordinarily dangerous because it leads to fascism. In this case, it would lead, in my opinion, to a form of privatized eugenics, you know?
You dropped the word fascism. Could you define that? And
well,
how that connects with...
And the totalitarian regimes in general want a homo novus. They want a new man. Always.
Okay.
They want to reform entirely the human. They want to make a worker. They want to make an Aryan. They want to make a soldier, blah, blah, blah. So that's all, about the fascist or totalitarian ideology. And I think that transhumanism at its worst is doing just that, except that it's privatized. So it's not the state that does that. It's rich people who are going to buy themselves a homo novus little kid or that sort of thing. So I am very, very much against that, yes. Mm.
We don't have time to cover everything that I want to cover with you. We didn't hit on continental philosophy writ large and critical theory in particular, which you have studied. And I have had several guests on my show that have critiqued critical theory. Maybe you would be able to add to my knowledge of that. And I don't know how much time you have, but would you be able to give like a... It's a whole other direction, but...
Yeah, it's a complex question because that's the problem of Translatio Studio Room, right? How do you translate a theory from the from France, let's say, to the U.S.? How does it arrive here? I'm in the U.S. now, so I'm saying here in this virtual world.
But you are seeing critical theory manifesting, or a version of it, a child of it.
Started a long time ago in the 1960s. It started with Derrida coming to Yale or Johns Hopkins. I forgot, probably Johns Hopkins, when he started his, you know, wonderful, actually fascinating lecture about the ends of man and so on and so forth. But so I wrote an article recently in a French newspaper, so it was not deep at all. But there was this, you know, but there was this idea that what we see now in critical race theory and other types of identity theories and so on, or some people call it polemically and with humor grievance studies. What we're seeing now is a sort of perversion of the French stuff, because the French stuff was very much universalist in spite of the criticism of universalism. So let me try to be very brief. The French did not really believe in identity. They did not believe in the notion of a fixed identity, right? So they had deconstructed this notion of a subject who is equal to himself or to herself in a race or in an ethnicity or whatever. What we are seeing now with the new forms of critical theory, I don't know if it's the right word, in the US, in this importation, is something very different. It's actually what I call fetishization of identity, which is really not at all. It's actually the exact opposite of the Derrida, the Blanchot, the Deleuze, the Foucault, and so on. It's completely opposed to that. Now, I never understood whether this is strategic or whether it is
emergent,
genuinely in intellectual. Because you remember Gayatri Spivak in 1980s, maybe, or 90s? She came up with a concept which I find very objectionable, is the concept of strategic essentialism. In other words, I, Gayatri Spivak, I'm against essentialism because I come from deconstruction and Derrida and existentialism and Beauvoir and so on. But... because it's politically profitable, I am going to affirm essentialism and race and so on. I think what we are seeing is actually the disaster of this type of cynicism, you know, of using an intellectual philosophical category for purely strategic reasons. One thing to be an essentialist, if you want to be an essentialist, that's fine. You know, you have an identity, and you're French, and the French have a national character, and I'm an essentialist. Okay. But it's another thing to use it for political, polemical, and even strategic purposes. I think it's a problem, because in philosophy, we have to be genuine in the search for truth. So that's what I think. So perhaps what we are seeing now is possible. You know, because that's always the discourse that you hear. That's the reason why we never know how to engage with critical race theory. We don't know how to engage because there is something profoundly, ontologically disingenuous in the whole project. Because when you say there are no race, so I don't see the color, so they say, you see, you're racist because you don't see the color. But then they're going to say, to respond to someone else who is a racist, whatever, there are no race because race are a construct. So it's almost impossible, right, to engage. We always lose in engaging with that sort of critical race theory. So that's what makes me very frustrated.
Okay.
Because I think we have to be genuine in philosophy and in thought.
Okay. But if it goes back to Socrates and the sophists, and if the sophists are, they don't care about truth, they care about power. So it's not about being genuine or being a hypocrite. Who cares about that? It's about advancing your political will.
Yes.
And if will philosophy not succumb to that cynicism and that power game? Will it not eventually be wrecked, or at least the academy or all the structures that support it fall under the heel?
It's already pretty much wrecked. I think that there may still be some enclaves of resistance, maybe in history, here and there, maybe in some departments of philosophy where they do, non-continental, or maybe in history of philosophy, what do I know? But in the humanities at large, writ large, I think it's not in a good situation. We're not in a good situation at all. Because I think that, yes, I mean, I think that this sort of cliché of power knowledge that comes from a very poorly digested Foucault is actually ruining thinking. Right? Genuine thinking, genuine engagement, where you can have a real dialogue, Socratic, where you can have, some real contradictory debate with someone, as opposed to, where do you speak from? Do you speak from the proletariat or the working class, as they say in the 1960s and 70s in France, right? They always ask, where do you speak from? Where do you speak from? D'où parles-tu? So, no, if you speak from the working class, that's fine. We're listening to you. If you speak from the bourgeoisie, we don't listen to you. It's the same, pattern. It's not thinking. It's agonistic. It's fighting. So, that's not what I want to do.
Do you project a path forward, a path towards restitution of genuine philosophical debate? Or rather, do you have principles that you can share that you would like people to implement in engaging publicly with other ideas that will cement a more genuine discourse broadly?
For me, everything that happens either in my study where I'm with myself and with my books, or it happens in the classroom. And I really think that there still can be very, very genuine conversation, discussion, and disagreement in a classroom. And I think it's up to us educators to try to create an environment, an atmosphere, I'm not going to say climate, which word I hate, an atmosphere of genuine contradiction, of genuine questioning and critical thinking. I think, I hope, I am still able to do that. Maybe, it will change. But for the time being, I'm still optimistic that I can still do that. And when I can't, I will quit.
Are your students receptive to that, or are they becoming infected with the power knowledge?
They are very much, very much receptive to that. In fact, students who work hard when they are face to face, if I may use that metaphor, with a text which is complex, and when we read it and dissect it show the many ways of reading it and how it resonates with our present and with our condition, which is basically the humanistic tradition, then I think that there is someone there who can listen and who can actually learn something. Yes.
Are you hopeful? Are French people hopeful? Are you a hopeful people?
French people, they do, woof, always do. I don't know. That's what we do.
Fair enough.
I'm a skeptic. So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So your book, you have articles here and there throughout the web. Do you have any books that people can check out? I saw one is for sale. It's about critical theory. Is theory good for the Jews? And that's an academic text right now.
It's published by Liverpool University Press. It's not been translated into French. It was well reviewed in Jewish Review of Books and several other places. And I have a book. I have three other books, but they are in French. And I'm working on a new book in English on the resurgence of the Gnostics in France from early 20th century to the present.
Hmm. So hopefully, I can have you back on my channel in about a decade when you finish that book.
Yeah, 20 years.
And, the thing about you academics, it takes 20 years, but at least it's readable for 25.
Maximum.
Yeah.
For 25 people, you mean? Yes. By 25 people. So a big thank to Aura, my friend Aura, also for giving you my name. It was extremely nice of her.
Yeah, this is very enjoyable. How do I pronounce your last name? Because that is a lot of vowels.
Shawat.
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 Okay. Yeah, okay. I can do that. That was my guess. All right, Professor. Well, thank you very much for your time, and have a good evening, and I'll let you know when this is up.
Thank you, Benjamin. Bye-bye.
Ciao. Congratulations for reaching the end of the discussion. If you enjoyed it, do be sure to leave a review or a comment or a thumbs up or whatever you need to do to show that glorious algorithm that this is some good stuff. And do be sure to go and check that back catalog, as it is brimming full of fantastic conversations. Links to provide monetary support are down there in the description as well. Have a good night.